Session number 17624, John Allen, Reel 5.
Mr. Allen, Reel 5. We're discussing the Home Guard, Mr. Allen. And you said that you had a lecture and as an
yes.
initial...
We started off with a lecture from a man who'd been obviously someone. He wasn't just a ranker from World War One, and it was very interesting. And they said they were going to train you in the use of weapons as they got them, because they only had... 6 rifles among a company of men of over 100 at the time. And you were asked to come down. That 100 was used up over each week. A 7th of them would be there. And you brought with you your gas mask, civilian gas mask. You brought a sandwich or a flask of tea. And everybody was very happy to have a flask of tea around them, you know. And some people hadn't one, so... You brought a flask of tea down, and you always had a cup of tea. And we began to know what this rifle was. And there were Canadian...
Ross rifle.
Pardon?
The Canadian Ross rifle.
That's right, the Canadian Ross. P14, I think they called it, if I remember rightly. And I'd never handled one before, but they were a long-nosed one. And
Were they a good weapon?
Oh, yes, yeah, very good. And you felt, oh, well, I'm learning something here. And my dad thought, my dad had never been in the First World War, you see. He was a railway worker and they were exempt. But in any case, he would never have passed because he had varicose veins. He would never have been accepted in the forces unless they wanted him in a sedentary position.
What kind of activities did you get up to in the Home Guard?
Actually, we did very little apart from going down and commanding that post at the end of the trading estate. And there was one night, there were several nights that I was on duty down there, and they had air raids, and they bombed several places on the Tyne, and the craft came over. And I remember one chap saying... If we had enough rifles, we could put the frighteners on these people. Because, I said, you would never reach them. I said, you'd probably never reach them. Although they might have. Because they were very low one night. And it added a little bit interest to it, you know. But otherwise, it was sentry duties round the pit itself, really. And a big pit head in the pit baths. In fact, we used to use them. They said you could use them. And I'd never seen pit baths before, but they were quite good. And they had a canteen there. And they sometimes used to have a lady or an oldish chap that obviously worked there anyway. And they would come in and do a little bit for you till about 10 o'clock at night and then go home and lock it up, you know.
Did you parade with broom shanks and things like this?
Well... Some people say that they did, but we never saw anything like that. We only saw about 6 rifles, and there were 2 revolvers, I remember, used by the men that were captain and major. That's the title they got. Whether they were given a full commission, I don't know. But I think they'd had a commission in World War One because they knew what they were talking about. And one thing that I admired about it was we were interested, at least I was, because I consider myself, when I got into the forces, that I was a good soldier. But you got the basic knowledge that you were in a group of men that had to move as one, you know. And when we went to Ravensworth Castle to the 13th Holding Battalion, I remember one of the instructors who had one eye, lost an eye in World War One, a Sergeant Wilson. He said to me, you've been in the forces, haven't you? You know something about the force. I said, no, I've been in the LDV. They could call it the Home Guard now. He went, and you learned all this? He says, you're way above these kids. And they were all 18s, you know, volunteers. I said, well, they may not have been in the Home Guard, but some of them had been, but they weren't getting the same, obviously they hadn't got the drill that we had. And I considered myself fortunate, because it was, it allowed you to digest the army much easier than if you'd come straight out from civilian life and being ramrodded into drills and things like that. But the Durham Light Infantry, with that battalion of youngsters, that they came from all over the county.
Yeah, we'll come to the mm-hmm. battalion.
But you're carrying on about the Home Guard.
We'll stick with the Home Guard just for the moment, anyway. And what was the civilians' attitude towards the Home Guard? Were you looked upon with some...
I think there
respect.
Used to be a little bit humour. You know, they used to look at them askance at times. But they were doing a good job. They really were. And they felt they were doing something worthwhile. And they were very, very, one would say, good-natured about it all, you know. They gave up that time, you know, the feeling is... I think you'll have heard this said many times. You're not that much younger than me, really. But the feeling was immense. There was a feeling about Britain that we've never had since. We had it through the war and after the war for a little while. And then it sort of, as the new generations came up, they knew nothing about it. But it's a feeling that you can look back on with pride, really.
Did you get uniform in time whilst you were
no,
there?
No. By the time I joined the forces, they still had the little LDV armband. And if your mother or your sister or yourself could use a needle, they made it far from a floppy thing that was falling down your arm. And you could pull it on. I elasticated mine, so it went on the arm. And... that was the only uniform that you had, really.
Did you get any more equipment, any more rifles, in that time again that you were there?
Not while I was there. In fact, I wondered what effect they would have had if anything had happened. But you could tell from what we saw of LDV, or Home Guard by then, in Darlington areas, marching about, fully equipped, in denim uniforms like Dad's army. And so they got better supplies later.
Did you do any manoeuvres of any kind whilst you were in?
No.
Just this guard duty situation.
We had one visit from York from an officer who was obviously told to liaise with the Home Guard, you know, and he did a quick tour, I suppose, of all the areas. And he'd been to Tyneside for several days, he said. And he said, the enthusiasm is marvellous. He said, really speaking, from 16-year-olds right up to the grandads. And that is what I found, too. It's quite a feeling.
And prior to yourself going into the forces... the disaster of Dunkirk arrived and disaster of France.
That's right.
How did that affect you when that information was coming through that we were being beaten?
Well, the funny thing was, I never saw a despondent face. You know, it's incredible what a nation can take. But, you know, this... we are an island race. And I think... we pulled back. How we managed to extricate an army from France without the might of Germany just finishing it off, I often ask myself, what intervened? Was it the Germans feeling that they were so superior they could afford to leave us isolated? Or was it an act of God? Was it tremendous courage on the part of those people that went out to pull this army back? And the people that stayed there to allow that army to come back, because the French, you know, a lot of people looked down and derided the French for falling. But the French, when you read history, some of their units were the shield that we pulled out behind. And it should never be forgotten, because they may have had men that didn't want to fight, but they had men that were good men.
So the public response to this wasn't a
it wasn't disaster. It wasn't heartbreaking or defeatist or anything like that. In fact, the soldiers coming back from Dunkirk, particularly the northern units, they were sent back to their areas. And we used to, living beside the railway at the time, no, I wasn't living beside the railway at the time, but you could go to an area, a spot where you could watch trains, and a lot of people did this, and you saw them all coming up in these troop trains, you know, and you knew various people that the son was coming home from Dunkirk, and we met a lot of them when we got in the forces. In fact, they formed the nucleus of our 70th, the youngest sergeant that come back from Dunkirk was a boy from Devon. And I remember him to this day. He was the youngest sergeant in the British Army, 1920, and a very blonde young man. In fact, you would have said that he was a German if you'd looked at him, but so many are, you know.
Do you remember his name?
I can't. No. And you know, if you thought, because you weren't encouraged to keep a diary, you weren't encouraged to have photographs or anything like that. You couldn't have a camera, but it would have been very, very worthwhile to have it. And it would have been even more worthwhile had I, and I've got the brain up here to do it, but I didn't think of doing what some men did, and that's take a documented history of what you're doing. One lad surprised me in the Leicesters. He said, I've recorded everything I've done from the day I joined. I said, well, where the devil is your log? He said, that's for me to know. You know, and it's incredible that, because that was going to be worth, you could write a book about that.
Can we come up to the time of your joining the army? Were you conscripted in, or did you go?
No, no. What happened was, I was working an average of 18 hours a day, which was something for a 17-year-old, because we'd had several men taken away, although we were supposed to be immune. And our boss, one of the owners was a man called Peddy, two brothers. And he said, I'm sorry, that's been wiped out. We're not considered vital enough. They can always get women to do this work, train them admittedly, and after a while they'll be pretty good. But it's the handmade stuff where the skill comes in, because the rest was done by photography and printing machines. And I said to myself, it came to August the 1st, and I was sitting having my lunch, which consisted of sandwiches and a pot of tea that the girls in the printing works would make for the parts of the shift that were having their break. And you staggered the breaks, you see. And I knew that in time I would be called up. I think they called you up at age 20 then. The first conscription was 20-year-olds, because our first boy that left, he just attained his 20th birthday, and he was away like that. And he'd just been married, so he was taken prisoner in Dunkirk, and he spent the whole of the war after that as a prisoner of war. And but anyway, I was having my lunch, and you know how you're sitting thinking and ruminating, and I thought that I looked into the future as far as I could, and I thought, this war's going to go on and on, because it's just starting. Since Dunkirk, we're now holed up in an island, and America had offered to give us so much lease land, and I thought, we're going to be in a tight spot unless we get America in beside us or someone else. But we didn't, of course. But we held out for quite a while. But we weren't doing much, you see. We were more or less replenishing our arms, which was perhaps a good thing. We got a breathing, a respite for a while, and we obviously made it to... We used it up well. Anyway, it was the 1st of August, so I was 18 years, 1 month old. And it suddenly dawned on me that I could join the army. I could walk out of there then and join the army. And I had left home at 7 o'clock in the morning, just my dungarees on for work, which were the forerunners of the jeans, you know, and a boiler suit. And it was encrusted with the composition that we use on the jelly tables, because you're pouring it out and you get it all over you, and you put those away and you get them washed or cleaned, whatever. And I thought, I'll take a walk along to the Union Road schools on City Road. There's a recruiting depot there. I thought, yeah, I'll take a walk along and see what I can see in my lunch hour. So I'd had my sandwiches and I walked away. Never said to a soul, I'm going along to the recruiting office to see what goes. And when I look back on it, I have to smile, because they must have been completely dumbfounded when John Allen wasn't even there for the afternoon part of the shift. And I was in a fairly important post doing the handwork. So I walked up to this sergeant standing, smart fella, and he's standing at the door. He said, what do you want? So I said, I think I want to join the army. He said, do you? I said, yeah. I said, what would you like to join? No, I said, I would like to join the forces, say, the initial question. He said, what would you like to join, do you think? I said, oh, the army. He said, oh, the army. Uh-huh. I said, he said, why? Why the army? There's the Navy, the Air Force. And he was army. So I said, I want to join the tanks. And being naive, he said, he used a wee bit kidology. He said, but you cannot join the tanks immediately. You must do so long in the infantry and get your training, and then you can join the tanks. I said, whatever way, that's what I want to do. He said, why not join the Durham Light Infantry? He said, that's your county regiment. I said, I said, I had uncles in it in the war, the first war. He said, there you are then. Do you want to join? Yeah. I'll get an attestation form. Here we are, come in. So I walked in. He said, when will I hear? He said, you've signed in. He said, you go for your medical now. I said, where do I go then? He said, straight through that door. So within an hour, I had been physically examined by about 7 different doctors.
Was it a pretty thorough examination?
Physical? Yeah, pretty thorough, you know. And the only thing they said to me was, adverse, was, you're rather light for your age. Now, that is common in this country because of the state of the recession, the lack of money for food. One doctor said to me, you're light, son, for your age. I think I was 8 stone something. He said, but we will put that right. He said, because when you get in the forces, if you're physically fit and we come and tell you you're A1 or whatever, you will be on a diet and exercise that will make a man of you. And we promise you that. So I said, oh, that's good. So I said, again, naive, I said, now, when am I told whether I'm okay? Oh, within half an hour, just take a seat outside, get dressed, take a seat outside, in the pasture from doctor to doctor, you know, and you were naked, walking around. And I'd never had that before, you know. And so I got dressed and walked away.
Did anyone ever, with you looking on, obviously being so young, did anyone ever ask whether your parents knew you were there? Or?
No, they never said a thing. In fact, I could have been a man from the moon. I could have been from any part of the world or anywhere. They never even asked you, are you British? It was incredible. But there was about 40 men altogether, from boys to fairly 20, at least 20, mid-20s, sitting in various tables, chatting. You know, I think I was about the only Tynesider. They were coming from all over the place, and I heard your accent, the Durham, the Darlington accent, you know, and I got talking to these lads, and there was one boy called Carr, George Carr. He was the first boy I ever made a friend of, and we were subsequently going to be Durham Light Infantrymen. Then there was another boy called Fagan from Darlington, and George Carr and Frank Fagan and myself, we all finished up in the Durhams. Anyway, we didn't know whether we were A1 or not at that stage. And he said, I'm from Darlington. George said, and Frank said, I'm from Darlington. Didn't know each other till we came here. So we said, oh, we'll stick together, the three of us. What's your name and whatnot? And there we are. So there was a staff man came out of medical coat on. He said, the following men are A1, will go straight into the forces, whatever branch of the services you want to be in, you've asked for. You have now taken the king's shilling, and you're a member of the forces. When I read your name out, move over there. Anyone not on this list hasn't passed the medical, and it's alphabetical. So I was A, and it was John Leggett Allen over there. Army, the next man was RAF over there. And there were 7 out of the 40 that hadn't passed the medical. And they were just told to go away and wait of conscription when they might be allowed to come into the forces. But they couldn't volunteer. They weren't fit enough. So I looked at them and I thought, that's a shame, because they want to join, you can see. Anyhow, there was about 11 of us wanted to join the infantry. Actually, 2 other boys wanted to be in the tank corps as well, and they were said, but I didn't want to be in the infantry, you know, but they said, you had to. I said, he told me that as well. We learned it was a load of rubbish, because we could have said, want the tank corps, please. You would have been put into the tank corps because you'd get your training there just the same. Anyhow, it was all to the good because you met a good bunch of fellas. I was very pleased with the men that I joined up with. And they took us to Burt Terrace Drill Hall from Newcastle, which was the old drill hall in Gateshead for the 9th Battalion. And I said to the sergeant, that took us. He came over to the schools and had a truck, and he took us all away. And I said, we were in this drill hall, and we're just sitting chatting. And there's no uniform yet, you fellas, so just hold it. You'll stay here the night, and then you'll be taken to wherever you're going to be trained. And I heard one of the officers that I took to be an officer, he was a warrant officer, actually, and he said, this lot is going to Ravensworth Castle. And I thought, my God, that's not, I can walk there. So I said, excuse me. He said, sir. I said, excuse me, sir. I'll just go home and let my parents know that I've joined the army. He said, oh, no, you won't. He says, you're in the bloody army, you know. He says, you'll just stay here. And you'll go tomorrow to Ravensworth Castle. And Ravensworth Castle will tell you when you can go home later on. So I thought, well, there you are.
How did your parents find out then? I mean, you'd gone off to work.
I'd gone off to work, and I didn't come in at night at neither 6 nor 9 when I would have had the first few hours overtime, nor by midnight.
And they must have been worried about your non-appearance.
Well, this is the thing, you know, and being a youngster, you don't think too far ahead, or you're not really concerned, to tell you the truth. So I didn't learn till later that my father had phoned the works, my works, and they said, John just disappeared. We don't know where he is. And he said, oh, he said, well, we have a feeling that he's joined the forces. So they said, ah, well, there's a recruiting office near the firm. We'll look into it tomorrow and we'll let you know. And that's how they got to know. And the recruiting officer said to them, oh, yes, John Leggett Allen, he's joined the Durham Light Infantry. And my dad had said to my mum, he's joined the army. She said, what? He's joined the army. He's volunteered for the Durhams. And they both said, he'll never stick it. He's never going to stick that. He doesn't know what he's done. But, of course, I did stick it because I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Your mother must have been upset for all that.
I think so. But you say to yourself, you try to compensate by saying, well, I'm doing this for my country, you know. But in the best of all worlds, had we had what we have now, nearly every home has a telephone, and you can get in touch, they wouldn't have been left high and dry. But I think I had two sisters at home at the time, and they must have made up for it. They must have said, look, Jack is a sensible fella. He's no fool, and he'll be all right. He'll get in touch.
What was the situation with the army at that time? Because at a certain age, or under a certain age, you couldn't go abroad.
I believe...
And you were 18-year-olds.
I was 18. I believe you had to be 20 before they sent you overseas. And yet, the funny thing was, there were men coming back from France that weren't 20, because we met some. In fact, the youngest sergeant had joined as a boy bugler, and he was graduated through the ranks till he was a company sergeant. And he became our first sergeant, that lad. And you know, he came back from, we said to him, how is your equipment sparkling, bleached like that? And he said, because I keep it clean. He said, I came from Dunkirk, I was at Dunkirk. And of course, to us, he was a hero. We thought, my God, here's a man that's been to Dunkirk. All these other fellas were World War I men. But there were several of them. And the picture post, do you remember that? Now, the picture post, on one edition of the picture post, it showed you troops coming back from the south coast ports. And this man was hanging out of the window of a train, and he was one of the Durham Light Infantry, and he was big, cheery grin. He was a Cockney. And I always remember that photograph because I met the man at Ravensworth, and he was one of the 20 or 30 men that had come back from Dunkirk. And we formed the holding battalion around them. And we got some good training up at Ravensworth Castle.